You're listening to Dig Deep on KEXE KBXE. We continue our conversation on immigration today. Our conservative commentator Chuck Marone and liberal commentator Aaron Brown. So I'm guessing we want to continue.
Yeah.
Why don't we go? We're going into the politics of it.
Can I start this one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So I brought these a couple quotes here, and I just want to read them to you to kick off this politics thing. And then I'd like to. We talked a little bit off air about the analogy with gay marriage and the way that the electorate has changed. I'd like to actually dig into that a little bit. So here's a quote. When I see Mexican flags waved at pro-immigration demonstrations, I sometimes feel a flush of patriotic resentment. When I'm forced to use a translator to communicate with the guy fixing my car, I feel a certain frustration. That was Barack Obama, 2005. Here's another one. Immigration reduces the wages of domestic workers who compete with immigrants. The fiscal burden of low-wage immigrants is also pretty clear. We need to reduce the inflow of low-skilled immigrants. That's liberal columnist for the New York Times, Paul Krugman. You look, in 2006, not in 2018. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In 2018, he would never say something like that. In 2006, that was a very common strain.
It was a widespread belief.
Yes.
A widespread sentiment, and certainly in a party that was worried about being labeled too soft on immigrants, was what you would say.
So here's my analogy, and I'd like you to react to this. And Heidi, please join in as well. If we look at the gay marriage debate and the evolution of the gay marriage conversation, what you had in the 90s is you had the most prominent Democratic politicians, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, saying we're pro-marriage, we are not for gay marriage. We think Paul Wellstone. We think a marriage is a man and a woman. Period. That's it. It's not open for debate or discussion. By the time you get to the mid-2000s, it's become a Republican wedge issue where the Republicans can point to the crazy leftists who've gone off, way out of the right out on the left, and now they want gay marriage. They're supporting civil unions, supporting all this stuff. Isn't this crazy? And it was a wedge issue to drive people out to vote.
Yep. George W. Bush famously rolled out the constitutional amendment.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden, you have an election year, and I can't remember which one it was, 08, 2010, where the Republicans said, we got this playbook, it works really well, we're going to, get everybody upset about marriage, that marriage is going to get taken away and becomes this crazy thing, and it didn't work. And in like a 6-month, 12-month period of time, everything flipped. Everything flipped, and now you had gay marriage state by state by state, Supreme Court at the national level, and now it's just a done deal. And people don't even, there are pockets of people who are upset with it. But for the most part, what you saw is this group in the middle shift to one way. We can talk about why that happened and what happened there. To me, the immigration debate right now feels very much the same with the way that the left has changed and really redefined what progressive thought is and what's acceptable thought. Here's the difference. I don't see the moderation point here. I don't see that group in the middle, how they shift in a way that aligns with where the left has been leading us on this one. And I'm interested to get your reaction to that. I'm interested to know if you think likewise.
So you brought up gay marriage, and this is not about gay marriage, but it's interesting, the study of that movement and how attitudes changed. And one of the things that they talk about, the people I know who were involved in the Vote No campaign to block the marriage amendment, the one man, one woman marriage amendment that failed in the state of Minnesota and really triggered, why Minnesota just in the very following session passed legal gay marriage. And one of the things they talk about, and I believe this is true because it certainly was true in my progression. In 1998, I was a delegate to the DFL state convention as an 18-year-old. And I voted against gay marriage in the platform, and I made my vote and marked it and turned it in. And a lady sitting across from me says, "I don't like your vote." And I'm like, "Well, I don't know. This is
I'm here. I get to vote.
Yeah,
same
this is
as
what
you.
I voted for." And well, it was a lady who became a friend of mine, Lori, and she lives with her partner, and she just explained, what she thought about marriage and why it applied to them and what it meant to them. And I didn't change my vote. I didn't think about it much at the time. I just, okay, well, that's an interesting point of view, but here we go. So I went from that to through the next few years. Really the difference for me, and this is what the organizers will tell you, is meeting people for whom this issue applies. And whether or not you see...
Let me put it a little bit differently. Yeah. Meeting people who were very much like us
yeah.
to who this applied. So gay marriage became less about feather boas and like the yeah, crazy it's not gay
like,
pride
it's not
parade.
Like the stereotypes of
yes,
gay people.
Yes,
it was about real people like our relatives, like people we knew.
The person who lives next right. door, I find out, is gay and has a gay, yeah. has a significant other.
Right. Right. And they're in all ways,
great people.
In all ways, they resemble our culture, our world. And all cultures in the state could identify, conservatives and liberals could identify people, you know, and it was this, you know, this humanizing thing that made like, well, why are we separating them out, making them different when they just want to be a part of us? And so your question is that going to happen or could that happen in the immigration debate? And I think the answer is, I think a lot of your people's attitudes about immigration come down to your experiences with immigrants. And if your experience is feeling uncomfortable because you couldn't speak the same language at the McDonald's and the feeling people get that when people are speaking in a foreign language that they're talking about them and some of these things that people have, and that's your experience, you're going to have a very negative view
yeah.
of immigration, of people. But if you talk to somebody who speaks English, who can tell you about their family, you know, one of the most powerful stories I heard this year was another student of mine, American citizen, born in America, but three generations ago, his father crossed the border from Mexico, or his grandfather crossed the border from Mexico, and they worked in the fields for two generations, and this kid now is going to college to play baseball. You know, he's like, you know, I don't know if he's going to be a pro baseball player. He thinks he is. I don't know if that's true. Good luck, kid. His dad now runs a auto body shop in another state and is a small business person. And, the whole family works there and they're, you know, reasonably successful, have a good life and enough for this kid to go try to find a college that'll let him play baseball in another state, you know? And so like, the story becomes very powerful. Like I can see like the value to America in this family and if you see that and you can see that a better immigration system that is fair, but also acknowledges the value that immigrants bring, then I think your attitudes about immigration move in the direction of reform and whether you want to call it amnesty or opening, maybe not opening all the way, but accepting immigration as a part of life in America, you might see more of that. Broadly speaking, though, the people in America understand that immigration is a good thing. More than half of Americans, actually 70% in a poll they did last week, see it as a benefit. The question is, what does that mean?
So let me.
What does that mean in policy?
I think that the progressive argument for most things, and this is why we see universities run by liberals and liberals attracted to all levels of education. There's this belief that like, if we just fix the humans, they'll work better. Like if we can just, we can teach them to be more tolerant by having them be around different diverse people. And if we just give them better ideas, they can fix themselves. And I'm just
explaining that those why people hold different views.
Right. But I do think that there's a certain amount of truth to that. Obviously, if you grow, I think one of the tipping point things in gay marriage was that we all, you know, you can say San Francisco, parts of Minneapolis, because of their historic tolerance for homosexuals, have been a place where you have a higher percentage maybe. But at the end of the day, we all stood up and looked around and said, there's gay people in every city. I mean, there's gay people everywhere. There's gay people in rural Minnesota. There's gay people in every state, in every community. They're all over the place. And once we realize that, and we realize that they're nice people and they're great people, they cease to become the other. They cease to become mm-hmm. people we fear. If you look at, for example, the Brexit vote, which largely was a proxy for immigration, because even now as they're negotiating what Brexit means, what they really want it to mean is closed borders for humans and open borders for trade.
And they're willing to take the hit, the Brexit supporters are willing to take the economic hit from
right.
lack of trade
right.
just to close those borders.
So the areas, and this was like a thing that drew the ire of especially millennials and urban people, the areas that had the least amount of immigrants were the ones who voted for Brexit. In mm-hmm. our country, the corollary is the places that are most fearful of immigration have the least number of immigrants. The places that voted for Trump largely because of immigration, those places are the ones that actually have the least amount of mm-hmm. immigration. So if you look at a progressive left leading this country towards, you know, if we want to call it a more tolerant, more open, more pro-immigration kind of policy, they have a different challenge than they do with gay marriage, because you can't fix the mm-hmm. humans, because you're not going to get them to just, you know,
yeah.
you can preach to them and say, immigration's great, you should be more tolerant. But that doesn't go real far when, like, I don't have a good job. I can't, you know, I've got people in my family who aren't working well. My city's falling apart. Yeah. My area's falling apart. I'm in this, like, historic, fragile decline. And the people lecturing me are, like, the urban do-gooders who are doing fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know, though. I mean, it's true that there are some people that describes that see this destruction in their community and are worried about immigration as a result of it. But there's a lot of perfectly... Like, my dad lives down by in Chisago County, and his neighbors are all very conservative, and he'll talk about how they go on and on about immigration and stuff like this. And these guys own companies. They wear the nice polo shirts, the shiny ones, you know what I mean? And they're not hurting. Their family's not hurting. It's not an economic argument for them. It's this broad notion that something of America will be lost by the introduction of immigration, by the introduction of people who are different. To that, I would argue that America is changing anyway. America is becoming more diverse as a function of birth rates and American life, and more people in interracial relationships, and just the nature of America is changing anyway, and that's what ticks people off.
I almost feel, though, and I don't say this to... I'm not attacking you.
So sure.
Let me say this.
I do feel
like there's a certain... I think it's a lazy or an easy argument for people to make on the left, where they just say, well, people, you know, conservatives are racist, or they don't want, you know, they don't want their lily white place to change and become multicultural.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you look at the history of immigration in this country, what you see is that in times when the economy is doing well and people feel secure and people feel like they have opportunities and like the next generation will be better off than ours, we become a very like pro-immigrant country. Immigration becomes like a non-factor, like bring people in. This is the pie is growing. When that changes, and you could see this in the Depression era, you can see this in the kind of anarchy area in the early 1900s. There are the times when we became the most, and I'll use the word xenophobic, or the most anti-immigrant, were times of deep stress and economic turmoil. And I think that if you want to call the result of that racism, I would call it more tribalism. Like when things are going bad, what you do is you hunker down with your tribe. And, you know, if we're in central Minnesota, the tribe all looks a lot like you and me. And so people who come here who aren't clearly not with that tribe, they're a threat. Is that racism? Is that xenophobia? I don't know. Because if you flip the switch and say, land of milk and honey, everybody can get a piece of land, everybody's doing well, you can go get a job and support your family, you don't have to work 60 hours a week and have two people working and still take on debt and fall behind, would people still feel that way? I think the left would say yes, because they're racist. I would say no, because they're more secure, and that will make them naturally more open to change.
I could buy that if for one important thing. The spigot on American immigration was closed in 1924 when the immigration reforms of the time were passed, and so this wave of European immigration was slowed to a trickle, and most of our immigrant stories in America occur before 1924, meaning white people like us, you know, and they talk about their family coming here. That was in the teens and tens and maybe early 20s, but 1924 is a time of great prosperity in the United States of America. But what it had that is similar to our time today is great economic disparity. And you had a sense that the ruling class was benefiting from this great economy, and that everybody else was getting hosed, and that perhaps immigrants could be blamed for this. It is not a coincidence that here in the Iron Range and in across Minnesota that whatever time the KKK had any feet in this state that were successful was in the 1920s. And it wasn't because of white supremacy like you see in the South, though that's certainly probably a component. It had to do with immigration, Catholicism. It had to do with the other and the scapegoating that occurred. And in the city of Hibbing, I'm doing the research, they used the KKK as an almost like a closet secret social civic group to gain control of the city council. And they did so on behalf of ultimately the most powerful people in town. And that's the part that I see. And so I don't doubt for a second what you described is a true feeling that some people have. Like, I'm getting hosed. I got relatives like that. I'm getting hosed. And so they went with Trump and with the anti-immigrant policy because it feels like it's not fair. It feels like it's not good. And if you say it's racist, they'll say, I'm not racist. And you'll have that whole argument because there's nothing that seems to trigger the Republican Party right now like telling them that a policy is racist that they happen to support. But I do think it's important to look at where that really the most racist part of American immigration policy came from, the mid-1920s, and it was a time of prosperity for the country, but not for everybody. And I think that the scapegoating of immigrants is an old tradition, not a new one. Trump didn't think of it. He merely is the latest guy to use that tactic. And it was Woodrow Wilson who did it in the 20s, and it was before that, and then it was the Republicans that followed him that continued it. But so I'm not saying it's a party label thing, but I'm saying like we tend to perceive this as like, oh, we're getting all kicked around economically, and so we don't want these immigrants coming in to take jobs. That's never really been how it works. It tends to be more about controlling the population and controlling who's in charge. And immigrants aren't, it's not that they take jobs, it's that they vote. And that they might not vote the way we want to vote and might not elect our buddies to the city council. This is just where I'm coming
from. Yeah, I think right now, unlike the gay marriage issue, I do think that the progressive left in this country doesn't have an outcome, an end policy outcome that would be acceptable to 80% of America. The broad majority of America is not going along with what the advocates on the left, and they're not able right now to either communicate that broadly, there was a shift in the rhetoric about gay marriage that really made it a mainstream thing. I don't see that happening, and I'll tell you, I'm not a Trump voter. I'm not a Trump supporter. I would be probably with the Gang of Seven working out a compromise on this, but you said triggered by the term race. I find myself reflexively, and I feel guilty about this sometimes, but I find myself reflexively supporting Trump policies when I see crazy people calling me racist for, you know, not being for what I think are clearly like insane open border kind of, you know, policies.
I think there are some radical proposals out there, but I don't know that it's true to say that the whole everybody who's not a Trump supporter supports those policies.
Right.
And that's, I think, that's a legitimate ding on the Democratic Party is what is the plan?
What is the plan?
And is it a plan that could perhaps garner some... You know, we've been close, and I think with the fullness of time, we can look back and say, you know, what Bush rolled out might not have been a bad idea.
But I don't think the Democratic Party today could propose what Bush rolled out as a policy approach and have the base with them.
Yeah.
And I do think
they rolled out Nixon's healthcare plan.
Yeah.
in 2009.
Well, but that same poll that Aaron referred to earlier said, basically asked people what's the most important issue in this upcoming election? And immigration's been in the news. It was the highest vote getter. It was still a plurality, but it was the highest vote getter. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the news organizations, like the New York Times, I saw an article that said, you know, this is going to be a referendum on detaining children and, you know, Trump's policy. When you actually dig into the numbers, it was a high vote getter, but it was because Republicans are saying this is motivating me. And, you know, the news coverage, I saw the very first photo I saw of kids locked in cages on Facebook. And I thought, oh my God, this is horrible. And that got all around. And then it came out 2 days later. Oh, that was taken during the Obama administration. And what it did is I think there is this huge credibility gap where, and you can do hashtag fake news. I think a lot of conservative voters think this is just like Democratic trickery trying to pull on the heartstrings of people.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, these are policies that the Obama administration has had.
And I just find that so frustrating because
it is frustrating
because Obama did some things. For instance, he deported way more people than Trump has so far.
Yep.
That's a fact. But, there,
and
what
nobody
I noticed,
showed up at airports to protest it. And
right. Because the perception of the issue was different at the time.
Right.
But I also think, like, what's happened with this particular policy, this is not something that the Obama administration did in terms of the separating children and having them in these individualized and the way they process the kids through the court system separately.
Totally agree.
That's new. And I'm willing to say that, you know, maybe that wasn't done as an outcome like Trump said, here's what we're doing, I put the kids in cages. I don't think that's what happened.
Right.
I don't think he's involved in the organization enough to even be able to suggest something like that. But I do think that it's the outcropping of failures of policy that have gone back. Not it's failing now, but it's failed in the Obama administration, it's failed in the Bush administration. It's failed really for decades because we don't have a good way. We aren't willing to admit that that we have to do something about all the Americans, the people who came here illegally, whose children are American citizens, but they're not, and they've been here for a long time. Are you going to throw them out? What are you going to do? What are you going to do about the Dreamers, the kids who came here when they were two, and they don't speak the Spanish language, but they're here? What do you do with them?
Right.
And so Republicans don't want to accept anything that could be called amnesty because politically people have decided amnesty is bad, especially in their base. And at the same time, you know, Democrats who are relying in part on immigrants and the children of immigrants in their base are now saying, well, we can't do anything about, you know, securing the border and we should just make all these people citizens. You know, it's tough to have a position other than that. And get through a primary,
right?
You know, even here in the state of Minnesota.
And this is where I think that you're giving me the eye, like
no,
maybe we're,
no, I'm
oh, okay. this is where I do think that the craziness of the conversation on the right, and I will call Donald Trump's policies, you know, provocative and crazy. They are. I don't support his immigration policies. I mean, the 7-country ban and all mm-hmm. these are crazy policies. But what has happened as a reaction is that you've gotten like you've emboldened or created room for the crazy analog on the other side. And I almost feel like what we're in right now is this vortex where I, as someone who would support like a moderate proposal, I'm forced to choose between two versions of crazy. And I feel lost. I feel completely mm-hmm. lost. Because I don't identify with either
also,
version.
Which
of
is also what happened in the 20s.
Because
you have the anarchist movement and the, you know, this was before labor had gone mainstream. And you had some very provocative and the response to Republican policies was very extreme. And therefore relegated to the minority, you know, and you had those huge Republican majorities and Republican White House years in the 1920s leading up to the Great Depression.
Right.
And the Great Depression and the collapse and then the rise of the New Deal and Roosevelt, which didn't happen overnight, took years and years and really was only solved by World War II. It just feels like, as a historian, it feels like we apparently have to do this all over again. We have to do it just that way,
right?
You know, for people to unite, to unite around some basic truths that, for one reason or another, people aren't willing to admit.
Right. If you look at the gay marriage debate, what happened is you had crazy rhetoric on one side, crazy rhetoric on the other, but then one of the two sides said, "Nope, we're going to normalize this across this broad stretch of people," and it changed everything overnight. I mean, in political terms, overnight. I don't see that happening with this one. And I see the more one side ramps up, the more the other side ramps up. And there's a benefit to ramping things up and not resolving this. And there isn't really a human way, because we're not going to wake up tomorrow like we did with gay marriage, and see that like the kind old lady across the street is actually, you know, in a lesbian relationship, and she's a nice lady, and boy, I feel guilty for not supporting her. You're not going to wake up tomorrow and say, oh, there's the Hispanic family across the street.
Yeah,
and
but those people were always there. And that's the thing is it was not just that those people showed up, like, oh, the normal gays showed up. It was that they were always there and they were forgotten or ignored in the community.
Yes.
And I think, ultimately it's a numbers game. And as we look at a more multicultural America and particularly a younger generation, the millennials, who are not kids anymore, they're all adults now. Right. They're all voting in this upcoming election. In fact, I just saw the millennials are going to have more voters or more potential voters than baby boomers for the first time. Whether or not they actually vote in greater numbers is to be determined because they're younger and that's typical. But this generation, if you look at their attitudes about immigration, and it's not that they're ubiquitous, they're all the same, but they are certainly less friendly to Trump's policies than the baby boom generation is.
Right.
And that, I think, is the thing, is apparently we have to, you know, wait until people who see it differently come into their own, and those are the attitudes that then rule the day.
Chuck, who benefits from those ramped up opinions on either side?
The Republicans do. Okay. Yeah, without doubt. And I guess that's what I was trying to say is that, you know, I think without the left's ability to normalize it across a broad population, the way they did with gay marriage, I think Republicans will benefit huge from it. And I don't think that's right. I don't like it. It's not the issue that I would want to resolve this issue, but as just a pure political issue, the more it ramps up, mm-hmm. the more it helps Republicans.
That was true of gay marriage, though, right up until the moment it wasn't.
And that's the point I made. Mm-hmm. Point I made right up until it wasn't. And the way it wasn't is because the left was able to normalize across this broad population. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's either A, an inclination, or B, a mechanism to do that normalization in the same way.
So there was, I'll just say this at the end here, but there was a protest in Grand Rapids, I think 150 people, this group Indivisible on immigration policies. And then another group in town, a conservative group, Itasca Taxpayers Alliance, took photos at that event and has been talking about it. And I think even I saw a paid ad from that group calling the Indivisible group a bunch of terrorists. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's that ramped up on a local level that there's nobody seeing anything in between there. And
right.
I didn't know those things were being thrown out that way after.
It's very scary. And to me, I think the way, I mean, if there's people listening to this and say, well, what can I do? I think that we have to talk about this in normal ways. I mean, I think we have to. Resist. God, I don't want to use that word because
that's a charged word.
That's a charged word too. Because
join us, Chuck, in the resistance.
Oh my gosh. I think we have
you
to.
Won, Aaron.
I think we have to push back, and I think we have to. I think we have to be willing. I think if you are on the right, you have to be willing to recognize that people who are very motive that people are being harmed here. And to their defense, I think most people on the right do. I think they have other concerns that balance that out. But I think acknowledging up front that our immigration policy hurts people, I think is an important acknowledgement to create a dialogue. Mm-hmm. I think on the left, resisting the temptation to label anyone who disagrees with you a racist or a xenophobe or a hate monger or a horrible person, and actually then maybe even taking the next step and acknowledging that they do have some legitimate concerns. You agree that there should be a cap. So like there's a degree.
I agree that there maybe should be a cap. I don't know yet. But
there's a degree of immigration that would be too much. Mm-hmm. Now we're actually having like an intelligent conversation. What would too much be? Because I think most conservative people would say, well, zero is the wrong number. 100 million is the wrong number. Okay, well, we start at two very extremes. Like, mm-hmm. where do we find it? Now we're having a normal conversation as opposed to one that is just hypercharged. There are a lot of racists in this country. I'm not going to argue that there isn't. But I don't think the foundational concern about immigration is racism. I think there are other legitimate concerns. And I think when we don't honestly have a conversation about those and honestly deal with those and just blanket label it racism or xenophobia, I think that what that does is it empowers the Trump rhetoric. It does to me. I find myself, and I said this, I'm not proud of this, but I find myself sympathetic to Trump's policies when, you know, the opposing view is like, if you don't go out in the streets and protest Trump, you are a racist and a xenophobe. I'm like, okay, where do I go with that? Like, I'm not standing with those people.
I see kind of a chicken egg argument here that I, one of the most concerning things about that I have seen personally is seeing the you'd mentioned that there are racists in this country, and there are racists in northern Minnesota, and the level to which they have been empowered to openly say and do racist things to the face of people is new, or maybe not new in the world, but
it's new in modern times.
New in modern times. And so the question is, So the Trump phenomenon obviously empowered them, made them feel comfortable doing that, and which came first, though, you know? And so this is for people, just from the point of view on my side of the thing, like, who are offended by racism, I guess is what I would, I'm just offended by it. It offends me, and it offends my understanding of what this country should be, and knowing that we have racism in our past and that we're trying to get past it. That kind of thing is disturbing, and as a result, you talk about the primal urges. You, when you hear that rhetoric used against you unfairly, you know, when I see the rhetoric being used, I return to a primal roots kind of place where I just want to strike down the thing that is empowering these racists. You know, and that's where this more extreme. This more extreme positioning on the left. It's remarkable when you watch like the governor's race or even the national races for different races around the country, even in places that aren't necessarily left wing, the way that liberal positions are now totally normalized, you know,
although
in a way that wasn't as true when obviously when Barack Obama, you used that quote at the beginning,
right.
When Barack Obama said that, we were in a different place.
Right.
And actually Barack Obama himself would be considered probably a little too conservative.
Right.
Just
the Barack Obama of 2005 would be.
Yeah, and even in 2008, like 10 years later,
right.
You would say that Barack Obama suddenly appears more moderate than he did at the time.
And this is where, you know, I think we at the end of the day, we would agree on this. But I do feel like when we define like... I'm searching for like the psychology term. Everybody has their own like internal bias. You know, you would take, they've done psychological experiments where they show people pictures of faces.
Yeah, and your reaction.
And your
to
reaction.
That. Yeah, cognitive bias.
And they will show African Americans pictures, and they will react in ways that would be deemed racist, in the same way that white people do, not to the degree, but in a way. When we label that as racism, I think what we do is we shut off a whole, we first of all normalize racism. Because what you're saying is that every single person is a racist. Therefore, if I call you a racist, I might as well call you like a human being. Mm-hmm. There's truth to that in a psychological sense. But in a political, rhetorical, cultural conversation, it's incredibly unhelpful. Because what it does is it says to me, Chuck Marone, you are a racist. And Donald Trump is a racist. And there's no, like, Donald Trump is a racist level 8.
Yeah, there's no degree. Know, no degree.
Like,
there's,
Hitler's a racist level
score.
10.
Yeah.
Right. And Chuck, you're a racist level 4. No, we're all racists. And so, like, basically, I'm 1 degree of separation from Auschwitz, which to me is like an insane conversation to have.
And in a way that, and I don't know if it's just being called a racist that is the worst part of this, but having that stew being bubbling on the stove is, I think it just makes the more extreme arguably racist policy appear more mainstream.
It does.
Because
it legitimizes.
Because it becomes, well, if you're going to call us racist anyway, let's just do it up. You know,
Rush Limbaugh. I have not listened to Rush Limbaugh's show for 20 years. But the 90s, I spent listening to Rush all the time. And he would, this is a very common technique. The left does it. You use the labels that they use for you as your label. So in the last election, we were all deplorables.
Yep.
Yeah, we're a basket of deplorables, you know, high-fiving each other. I remember in the 90s, listening to Rush Limbaugh. Hey, you know, all my racist, homophobic, you know, misogynistic audience members. It was like, you know, what it does is it takes the people who truly are deplorable or truly are racist, and it puts them in a mix with all of us, and it normalizes it. And I don't excuse the true racists, and I don't excuse the true misogynists and whatever, but I do blame the left for that because it's become such an easy, rhetorical device to fall back. It's such a lazy rhetorical device.
What are we to say to racist policies then? What are we to, you know, and
I think that you have to first look for another inspiration for the policy other than racism. I think racism can be one of them, but it can't be like, oh, that's racist. Because really, we can make, if we sat here and disciplined ourselves and said, we're only going to make an economic argument, no race, no class, no, we're just going to make a pure macroeconomic textbook argument for banning immigration, we could do that. And then we would release that, and then, you know, a third of the country would say, that's racist. And, like, we had no conversation about race in it at all.
Maybe, but then you see the actual policy of the seven countries that are Muslim that can no longer travel. And you see policies like that and make an argument that really it's, maybe not race, maybe it's religion, but whatever. It's still, a highly biased kind of policy. And words have meaning, but that sometimes they are the right words, you know.
Here's a nuanced way to say this that I think would go a long ways. I think if we said, and I'm trying to like get to a place where we can talk about these things because that's what needs to happen. If we could say the outcome of that policy is a racist outcome, as opposed to the inspiration for the policy. Mm-hmm. Is a racist inspiration, that would go leagues towards letting us talk about things. When people say you have systematic racist bias, I have gotten to the point where I can interpret that as I have unconscious bias and how do I set up systems that are less impactful from a racial standpoint. But it is a hard thing to not hear someone calling you a racist.
Well, and this is kind of what goes back to conflict resolution, the use of I statements rather than you statements. You always do that. If a husband and wife are arguing, you always do that creates a situation with an almost impossible good outcome. Whereas if you say, I'm really upset because you did this thing and
here's how it impacted me.
Here's how I was affected by
it.
And so I don't think I'm disagreeing with you about the notion that just calling someone a racist is not a policy debate. You know, it's a name calling thing. But it is okay to call a policy racist, and it is okay to point out, a racist history in the country.
I agree with both of those statements.
And acknowledge that those are things that we should be considering when we make these policy decisions. So I want to meet you halfway on that, because it's not fair to call...
But you said you want to stamp out the things that are empowering racists, and I'm with you. I'm with you. Like the racist right terrifies me. It does. They have no place in our society. They should be rejected. But to me, what is empowering them? It's not the racists. Let me put it this way. We are always going to have racists. We always will. Hopefully, there'll always be a fringe that we will keep marginalized on the fringe. And whenever they pop their head up, we as a society will say, nope, those people are not us.
I'm going to give you something. I hope you accept it as a gift. one of the things I have noticed, and it's true of both sides, I guess, but I definitely have noticed it among my liberal friends and maybe not friends, but acquaintances, especially in social media, is we live in a culture that is quick to condemn people. And is quick to identify a person and make them the scapegoat for a policy or a situation or even just an unfortunate occurrence and say that they're this, this, and this, and this, and that that person basically is then ruined. You know, until that person is ash on the ground, that no one is satisfied. And I think that's where a lot of this extremism...
Really? You wouldn't do that to someone like Al Franken, would you?
Well... Al had,
but you see what I'm going there's
so but that gets into the thing.
If the revelations of Al Franken came out today, he would still be in the Senate. They would not have run him. It was because of that
when they came out.
It was because of when they came out.
Yeah,
and I'm not excusing Al Franken.
No, because he did behavior that is not acceptable.
Yes,
but and there are pictures, and that was ultimately why he lost the Senate seat. That is an example of like, well, what do we have a scale here? You know, and what's the scale on these things? And is supporting a person for a reason that is not racist the same as supporting them for a racist reason? And how do we even know what the reasons are? Maybe the people don't even know why do we do this? Why do we pick my wife is saying this kind of funny. They're shopping in town. A person, the checkout people, there was a young black man who was a clerk at the store, and he had no one in his line, and everybody else's lines were super long. And so she went to him and she's like, she's got a sense that he picked up on why people weren't taking his line. Now, was every other person in the store racist? But no, I would say every one of them would say, no, we weren't. It was just, you know, it was probably just what they were comfortable with. Maybe just subconscious. Maybe they didn't even notice. You know, but
maybe they knew the kid working in the other line.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. But I think there's a lot of stuff that people do unconsciously and maybe don't pick up on it. And as you point out, when it's brought up, like when it's pointed out that I have flaws, for instance, can you believe it, Chuck? I have flaws.
Right.
And when someone says something, maybe in an inartful way about one of my flaws, I react defensively and very angrily, you know, and that's a natural human reaction. I think we see a lot of that, especially when you throw the word racist around, because it's a word that ends careers. You know, it's a word that ends careers. And so the reaction is very negative. Makes it hard to talk about the real problem. I guess I want to meet you on that.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I don't know what life was like in the 60s. In the 50s when you had segregated drinking fountains. And I feel like, you know, we look back at that and what we see is something that from our eyes is clearly wrong. And so it clearly justifies like whatever action on the other side was needed to point that out and shut that down and make that change. None of us lived through that. So none of us know, like, were there people at the time who was the Chuck Marone equivalent going, if you just lowered the rhetoric, we could talk through this. So I'm cognizant of that. And I'm cognizant of the fact that 30 years from now or 50 years from now, we may look back at today and say, boy, Aaron was a total racist and he agreed with Chuck, that total retrograde, you know, whatever. I'm just saying, like, I look at it right now and what I see is the normalization of racism on the right, not because there's a growing number of people who want segregated drinking fountains and think, you know, whites are superior to blacks, but because there's a tribe forming of people who feel assaulted and afraid that if I don't think the right thing or say the right thing or go to the right checkout line in Target, I am as bad as the guy who's one degree away from Auschwitz, you know, and that's a really hard cultural stew to have a good conversation in.
You go where you're comfortable. People go where they're comfortable and that is universal in human nature. And if it's more comfortable to hang around people and vote with people who, you know, maybe some of them hold these outrageous ideas, but they're not going to really get in your face and scream names at you.
Right.
Then you're going to probably go with those people.
Right.
You know, and that's probably true of everybody.
I know we're done. You see this right now in like Chicago, in one of these like hard, deep blue districts. There's an actual person who is a self-proclaimed Nazi running for the whatever the elected seat is. And the fascinating thing about it is that I think Aaron made this case that what is done today is that all these people who were hiding under rocks 3 years ago are now feeling empowered to come out into the sun. We need to put them back under the rocks. I don't think you put them back under the rocks by creating this cacophony where, like, if you don't, because he's running as a Republican and they're going to the Republicans going, are you going to denounce this person? Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are, but some of them aren't. And then when they don't, they're like, well, you're just as bad as him.
Yeah, and you saw it when, like you mentioned Al Franken earlier, when he resigned, he had raised a bunch of money for Tim Walz, and the Republican Party was like, Tim Walz, do you denounce him? Do you renounce all this money? And so it becomes this whole tactic that gets used.
Yeah.
Sure.
So I think if we want these people back under the rock, which is where we want them, we don't want them part of mainstream conversation. We have to be able to say, like, that policy has these racial implications. That is not an acceptable policy. That's not a racial superiority is not an acceptable viewpoint in our society, period. But we're going to have this conversation without labeling the vast majority of people, who are right of center, racists. They're not. They're humans, and humans are flawed. And we all have those flaws. And the way we deal with it is we have to have a conversation about it. You can't have a conversation in today's society. You can't.
I think we just did.
We did.
You did. There we go. They fist pumped. Don't forget, August 21st, Chuck and Aaron and I will be asking questions of the two candidates that will finally be decided in the Minnesota primaries on August 14th. So first of all, go to your primaries.
For governor.
Yeah. And then August 21st at the Rife Center in Grand Rapids. Free tickets available. It holds 600 people. It's going to be live on TV and radio across the state.
We're going to grill the next governor.
Yeah.
And, we're going to hold their feet to the fire.
Maybe we'll make them both cry.
Maybe
wouldn't
we'll
that
make,
be fun? It'd be the first debate.
The first debate where they both cry.
They both cry.
Yeah.
It's dig deep.